Welcome to The Issue Is. I'm Alex Michelson. This week, two very big names in Democratic politics. Hakeem Jeffries, the Democratic minority leader in the House, who would become the Speaker of the House if the Democrats take control of the House, as is, frankly, widely expected. And Senator Alex Padilla, the senior senator from California, both of them exclusive guests on the show. But let's begin with Leader Jeffries, his first time on the show. And we ended up with a wide-ranging conversation on a lot of topics, from California's role in this election to the Trump-Biden match to TikTok to Ukraine and Israel to the border. We talked about his background. We talked about Nancy Pelosi's impact on him, the notorious BIG. This is a comprehensive conversation with a lot of nuggets on things that I never knew before. And so I hope you enjoy this full, unedited conversation with one of the most powerful people in the country. Here is Hakeem Jeffries.
Joining us now here on The Issue Is for the first time is House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries. Welcome.
Great to be with you.
So there are a lot of commentators that believe that the key to the Democrats winning back the House is California. Do you agree with that?
Well, California is going to be an incredibly important state. It always has been, particularly under the extraordinary leadership of Speaker Pelosi. But when we look at the numbers, we're four seats short of taking back the House. Now, there are 16 seats that Republicans now hold that President Biden won in 2020. Nine of those seats are in New York and California, four in New York, five in California. And so by the numbers, the opportunities are disproportionately weighted between our two states. And that's why California is going to be so incredibly important.
So basically, if you win back New York and California, you are the speaker. And let's talk about it, because what you're really good at is concisely giving the argument. What is, in like one or two sentences, the biggest difference between a Democratic House and a Republican House?
Well, a Democratic House will continue to put people over politics and to fight to make a difference on the issues that matter. Lower costs, better paying jobs, safer communities, defending democracy, and of course, protecting a woman's freedom to make her own reproductive health care decisions. A Republican House clearly is going to give the American people more of the chaos, the dysfunction, and the extremism that we've seen on display from the beginning of this do-nothing Republican Congress.
Although they would say you get more border security, other things that they would say if you get a Republican House, obviously. But that's part of the debate here. Are there particular districts, one or two districts in California you're especially focused on?
Well, there are two seats that are very important for us in the Central Valley, where we have two strong candidates, Adam Gray and Rudy Salas. Of course, we have to make sure that we hold the seat that is going to be vacated by Katie Porter in Orange County. There's a seat in the Antelope Valley where George Whitesides is a strong candidate who's running against Congressman Garcia. And then, of course, Will Rollins, who's running in Riverside County and in Palm Desert, Palm Springs area, is doing a tremendous job. And so we're really excited about the candidates that we have. I'm learning California geography. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we have to make sure that we return Mike Levin and Josh Harder to the United States Congress as well.
Have you had In-N-Out yet?
I have not had In-N-Out yet on this trip, but in the past I have.
Okay, very good. Obviously, this is all happening in the context of a presidential election as well. We just had the State of the Union. You spoke about that. Here's some of that.
Smoking Joe Biden was on fire during the State of the Union address. He was lit.
Lit is not usually a word used by Speaker Johnson. So let's talk about the states of that, too. The big difference between a Trump presidency and a Biden presidency.
Well, as President Biden made clear during the State of the Union address, and he was on fire, he delivered a tremendous forward-looking speech, making it clear that he wants to continue to build an economy from the middle out and the bottom up. He'll protect Social Security, protect Medicare, protect the Affordable Care Act, protect a woman's freedom to make her own reproductive health care decisions. And of course, under a Trump presidency, everything is at risk. Social Security, Medicare at risk. As the former president recently made clear, he will go after those two important parts of the American dream and end Social Security and Medicare as we know it. Certainly reproductive freedom will be at risk because under a President Trump and Republicans in the House and the Senate, they will march us toward a nationwide abortion ban. They want to criminalize abortion care. They will not stop until that happens. That's their ideological crusade. We also, I think, will continue to see an economy that is geared toward growing the middle class under a President Biden in the next 4 years, as opposed to focusing on the wealthy, the well-off, and the well-connected, which is what many of my Republican colleagues specialize in doing.
But Trump himself has not called for a nationwide abortion ban, and he also hasn't called for the end of Social Security.
Well, the end of Social Security as we know it, because in its current form, we can't afford to have cuts to Medicare and cuts to Social Security. And Donald Trump clearly, in his own words, said that's exactly what he will do. Now, his campaign walked away from those comments and walked them back, but we should believe him when he says it.
Big story this week on Capitol Hill, TikTok. There was a bill to ban TikTok if they do not divest from the Chinese company ByteDance in the next 180 days. It passed overwhelmingly in the House. You supported it. Why do you support it?
Well, I don't support a ban on TikTok, of course, but I do support divestiture in terms of ByteDance and their ownership of TikTok, because that essentially means that TikTok is functionally owned by the Chinese Communist Party. Not a friend of the United States of America or the friend of our people, but an adversary to our people. And the ownership of TikTok by ByteDance basically creates a situation where user data and user privacy is greatly at risk. And so a divestiture which will allow for TikTok to be owned by an American company, I think, is in the best interest of everyone. And it will allow TikTok users to continue to benefit from the platform that many of them so enthusiastically embrace.
I mean, you say you don't support a ban, but if there isn't divestiture, it is a ban, right?
Well, let's take one step at a time. The bill passed out of the House. We have to see the progress that is made in the Senate. And then, of course, it will go to President Biden's desk. But I do believe that this approach, not an outright ban, which is how some are framing it, but steps toward divestiture, and there will be a lot of people lined up prepared to purchase TikTok as a lit social media property. I don't think there are going to be any challenges there.
I mean, we saw Steve Mnuchin, the former Treasury Secretary, expressing interest this week. Do you know of any other people that are interested in that?
Yeah, I don't know of anyone privately who has expressed interest, but certainly I think there are many people who are close to Silicon Valley or the investor community who have made clear to us generally that if this bill were to become law, they have no doubt that there will be a lot of opportunity in terms of people expressing interest in purchasing TikTok.
So TikTok says the Chinese government doesn't have any control over the data. They say that's not true. We don't share the information with them. Do you have specific evidence that they do?
Well, I'm not at liberty to reveal classified information, and I think the classified presentations did create a lot of concern for Republicans and Democrats who were able to hear that information. But what we do know is that the Chinese Communist Party, which is not an entity known for respecting privacy or civil liberties of its own people, let alone the American people, does have the ability and visibility, if they so choose, to have access to all of the private data and personal information of the more than 170 million or so TikTok users in America. And that's a problem. That should concern everyone.
But are they accessing that?
Well, you know, that remains to be seen in terms of what is publicly available. But what I think I can clearly say is that they have the opportunity to do it. They can make the determination at any moment in time to do it. And they can also weaponize the platform in terms of disinformation. And there's reason to believe that in a variety of different areas, that has already taken place. Maybe not directly ordered by the Chinese Communist Party, but certainly not not being done in terms of how the algorithms are managed in a way to promote American values at all times.
Another big story of the week is what's happening in Israel. Your colleague from New York, the senior senator from New York, Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, highest ranking Jewish American in the history of the government, speaking out this week and suggesting that it may be time soon for new elections in Israel. Here's some of that.
And I believe that holding a new election, once the war starts to wind down, would give Israelis an opportunity to express their vision for the post-war future.
Do you agree with that? Is Senator Schumer right?
Well, I'm going to personally refrain from commenting on whatever may or may not take place in Israel in terms of the current government or the new government, other than to say that I've got full faith and confidence in the Israeli people to make the right determination about what their future should look like. And I think it's going to be important for our two countries to continue to lean into the special relationship that we have. Shared democratic values, shared strategic interests. In terms of what's happening on the ground, what I would say is that three things need to occur. One, Israel, of course, has to be able to decisively defeat Hamas. It's a brutal terrorist organization, and it needs to be defeated for the good of the Israeli people, the Palestinian people, peace in the region, and of course, the free world. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we got to make sure that we are doing everything possible to get the hostages out and to surge humanitarian assistance in so we can help innocent Palestinian civilians who are in harm's way in Gaza through no fault of their own.
So you're not ready to go as far as Senator Schumer went?
Yeah, my view, and this is just my view, I'm going to keep the focus on what needs to happen in the moment. And in my view, that's defeating Hamas, hostages out, humanitarian assistance in. And also, I think we all do need to be prepared. And first of all, I think it should be clear, there is no one who's been more pro-Israel throughout his entire career than Chuck Schumer. Mm-hmm. No one. He's got the best interests of the United States and the best interests of our allies all across the world at heart. But my view is that once we can get to the point of the day after, then I think we should be prepared for the reconstruction of Gaza. We should be prepared for partnering with moderate Arab states like Jordan and Egypt, working with Israel and perhaps some of the Gulf states. We should be prepared for what new Palestinian leadership looks like. And we should figure out how do we get a just and lasting peace in place through a two-state solution.
Speaker Johnson suggested this week that he may do a standalone bill to fund Israel, potentially with Democratic votes. Would you vote for that?
Well, my view continues to be that we have a bipartisan, comprehensive national security bill that came over from the Senate with the support of 70 members of that body, Democrats and Republicans, that should receive an up or down vote on the floor of the House. Because we all know if it does, and this is a bill that provides support for Ukraine, for Israel, for our democratic allies in the Indo-Pacific, and provides humanitarian assistance to civilians in harm's way in theaters of war across the world. If that bill hits the floor, it will pass with at least 300, if not more, votes. That's the clearest path to protecting America's national security interests. And really, in my view, and I say this respectfully, as it relates to the House Republican leadership, that's all that needs to happen. And if that were to occur next week when we get back to Washington, then we can get this done.
But if he says, we're not going to do that, but I will give you a standalone bill on Israel and I'll give you a standalone bill on Ukraine, do you support that?
Well, we'd have to look at the parameters of what also was included. What do we do with our allies in the Indo-Pacific? What are we going to do about humanitarian assistance? What they've done before is to leave out humanitarian assistance. And we've made clear now, not once, but twice, that's a non-starter. That's a non-starter. We have a leadership place in the world for a reason, and we cannot abandon it. And this whole issue about not funding Ukraine, which makes no sense because Vladimir Putin is a brutal figure and an enemy of the United States, of freedom, democracy, and truth. Ukraine is fighting for freedom, democracy, and truth. And that's where the United States should continue to be.
I mean, you've spent a lot of time with Zelensky over the years. If we don't fund Ukraine, what happens?
If we do not fund Ukraine over the next few weeks, then Ukraine is at risk of being overrun. And that would be a catastrophe, not just for Ukraine, but for our allies in Western Europe and throughout NATO, as well as for the United States of America. Because we have a commitment to supporting our NATO allies in the region. And if Vladimir Putin is allowed by the pro-Putin forces in the Republican Party to overrun Ukraine, there's nothing but NATO allies in the neighborhood. And if Putin goes into Poland or Romania or Slovakia or some of the other Baltic states or other states in the area, then the United States has an Article 5 NATO commitment to get in the fight. And at that point, you're talking about U.S. service women and men on the ground, lives on the line. We have to do everything possible to avoid that.
One other note about what's happening in Congress right now. Obviously, there was this push to do a bipartisan border bill that didn't make it in the House. Is there any sort of active conversation at a high level to do a border bill in some capacity during this Congress? Or is that essentially dead?
Yeah, well, House Democrats have made clear from the very beginning that we will find bipartisan common ground with our Republican colleagues on any issue, whenever and wherever possible. And we've repeatedly done that throughout the 118th Congress, and we'll continue to do that. With respect to the issue of the border, we've made clear we have a broken immigration system, and we have clear challenges at the border that must be addressed decisively. We need a strong, a secure, and a humane border. And we're willing to work with our Republican colleagues on that issue because any solution has to be bipartisan in nature. The problem is that Republicans, instead of trying to find the common ground necessary using common sense in order to achieve the common good and work with Democrats in a bipartisan way, they're playing political games because they would rather use the border as a political issue in November then solve the problem right now.
So it doesn't sound like there's active negotiations.
There are no active negotiations, but our openness remains. Yep. We are ready, willing, and able to get this done.
We are speaking with Hakeem Jeffries, the Democratic leader in the House, and this is your first time on the show. And for some people watching, this may be their first, introduction to you. Can you tell us a little bit about you and what made you want to get involved in politics in the first place?
I was born in Brooklyn Hospital, raised in Crown Heights, a working class neighborhood in central Brooklyn, grew up in the Cornerstone Baptist Church, kind of came of age in the 80s into the early 90s, in the midst of the crack cocaine epidemic, tough time, in Brooklyn, in many inner city communities across the country. Thankful for, a nurturing family and a nurturing community. And after graduating from law school, practicing law for a few years, just decided that I wanted to use my legal training, hopefully, to give back. And ultimately pursued public service, ran for office, initially unsuccessful, ultimately got elected to the state assembly, and sort of the rest is history from there. And it's just an honor to be able to serve the public and now the country for such a time as this.
And potentially replace Nancy Pelosi as speaker. What is the most important thing that she taught you about that job?
Well, Nancy Pelosi, I think, taught us to be inclusive but decisive, to make sure to involve everyone because, our diversity is our strength, as she consistently has pointed out. But as she has also said, our unity is our power. So at the end of the day, we got to make a decision and decide how to move forward and do it together. It's just an honor, to be able to follow in Nancy Pelosi's incredible footsteps. I mean, Nancy Pelosi, I've said repeatedly, is kind of like the Serena Williams of the House of Representatives. She's the greatest of all time.
And is that intimidating then? The spot of like going up right after her?
I mean, it's not the easiest thing in the world, but we're doing it collectively.
You're doing it with your own style. How's your style different?
Well, I think from my view is that, everybody matters within the House Democratic Caucus. The progressives, the New Dems, the Blue Dogs, people from California, New York, the Heartland, the South, the Southwest, the Rocky Mountain states, right? We are a gorgeous mosaic within the House Democratic Caucus. And I think I just continue to try to embrace that, to work with everyone. The leadership team is incredible. Pete Aguilar and Ted Lieu, both from Southern California. Of course, Catherine Clark from Massachusetts. And we're all just going to continue to move forward, row together, and put people over politics.
Of course, the immediate replacement to Speaker Pelosi was another speaker from California, Kevin McCarthy. Yeah. What was he like behind the scenes?
Well, you know, I mean, I think we had an open, communicative, forward-looking relationship. Of course, we didn't agree on most issues, but we did agree to disagree without being disagreeable. And that's the same approach that I've tried to take with Mike Johnson. For the good of the country, I think whoever is in these leadership positions, we have to be communicative with each other to figure out where is the opportunity to find common ground, where are we going to have to battle it out, and how do we, I think, continue to try to come together around core issues like democracy and freedom and, you know, embracing patriotism in terms of tackling problems that aren't Democratic issues or Republican issues, they're American issues.
How does Johnson maybe differ from McCarthy?
Well, I think Johnson is clearly a committed, you know, right-wing, socially conservative Republican. But he believes what he believes, and we strongly disagree with each other on a whole host of issues. But he's come into a difficult situation. And I think we've tried to work together as best we can to fund the government. We've avoided a government shutdown now on multiple occasions. We've passed the first six of 12 spending bills. We're working on the final six, which hopefully at some point upon our return to Washington next week, we'll get that done. And then we'll see what other opportunities exist to advance the ball for the American people.
You feel good that the government will be funded next week?
I'm pretty confident that we will avoid a government shutdown. We'll fund the government, and we'll do it in a manner consistent with our values.
I'll talk a little bit more about you. You posted a really beautiful and loving tribute to your father last year on Instagram. And as we get to know you, can you talk to us about the most important lessons he taught you?
Well, you know, I think loyalty, love for family, and a quiet dignity and strength were some of the things that I think Dad tried to pass down to my younger brother and myself. He was a substance abuse social worker, spent a lot of time in the community during some difficult, challenging moments, you know, back at home in the heroin explosion of the 70s, the crack cocaine epidemic in the 80s and 90s. He saw a lot, and he really cared for others. And, you know, my mom, who also, you know, was a caseworker, you know, working for the Health and Human Services entities back at home, as well, that community for them was always important, and I think that was something that was passed down to my younger brother and myself.
Somebody else you're a big fan of is Notorious B.I.G., and you got a lot of attention when you went on the House floor and said this.
It was all a dream. I used to read Word Up magazine. Salt
and pepper. How does the Notorious B.I.G., who is, of course, proud son of Brooklyn, from your district, shape your worldview?
Well, that tribute occurred on the 20th anniversary of his passing, which I hadn't fully processed earlier that day on the House floor. And then Stacey Plaskett, a representative from the Virgin Islands, said to me, you know, it's the 20th anniversary of the passing of Notorious B.I.G. When you go back to the office, put the radio on, they're playing all of his music. So I did that, and I got inspired. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know what? I'm going to go to the House floor. I'm going to deliver a tribute to the Notorious B.I.G. Someone from my staff said, you can't do that. I said, well, check the congressional record. You tell me whether Frank Sinatra, Elvis Presley, and Bruce Springsteen all appropriately have received tributes on the House floor in the past. 45 minutes later, they came back and said, yes, all three have multiple times. I said, good. The Notorious B.I.G. is getting ready to get a tribute as well.
Yeah, but what has you learned from his music? What does he mean to you?
Well, I mean, I'm a proud son of Brooklyn, as you said. Grew up a few blocks from where I live right now. I'm proud to represent the neighborhood where he is from. Proud to know his mom. And, you know, I think one of my favorite songs that he's written is something called Sky's the Limit. And it talks about the journey of where he came from, incredibly humble beginnings, and where he was able to end up, you know, as an international hip hop artist, the work ethic, the heart, the soul that it takes. And also, I think it, in his own way, is reflective of what the American dream represents, which is opportunity. Work hard, and you can go places that in other parts of the world you would never imagine you can get to or could not get to.
Yeah. If you know, you know.
If you don't know, now you know.
After that. So we've got, we do a game to wrap things up called Personal Issues. This is 30 seconds, cultural favorites. First thing that comes to mind to get to know you a little bit better. All right, ready? Here we go. What's your favorite TV show?
Game of Thrones.
Favorite movie?
LA Confidential.
Favorite sports team?
Knicks.
Favorite athlete?
Reggie Jackson.
Favorite way to relax?
Go to the movies with family.
What is your favorite rap lyric of all time?
Well, other than if you don't know, now you know, which I've already revealed, I would say, you know, there's a lyric from the Wu-Tang Clan, which has always stuck with me. We've got stick-up kids, corrupt cops, and crack rocks, and stray shots, all on the block that stays hot. But leave it up to me, and I'll be living truth, to kick the truth to the young black youth. Shorty's wondering why I'm smoking cess, drinking beer, and ain't trying to hear what I'm kicking in his ear. Neglect it for now, but yo, it's got to be accepted that what? That life is hectic. Mm. And I always thought that that was just such a powerful encapsulation of like tough inner city life, and also the hope that, you know, you can pass along the roughness of the journey to someone young. Wu-Tang Clan.
Very nice. Wow, got a whole performance there. That was excellent. Thank you so much for coming on. It's really great to talk with you. Hopefully we get to talk to you more in the competitive year ahead for California. Our thanks to Hakeem Jeffries. Now to the senior senator from California, Alex Padilla, who's been with us several times in the last couple months. But this week, his team reached out wanting to make an announcement that was not a very surprising announcement about who he sees as his future colleague. So here is our full unedited conversation with him. California Senior Senator Alex Padilla. Welcome back to The Issue Is.
Thank you, Alex. I know it's from afar. We'll be back in studio next time, but good to be with you tonight.
All right. So in what is going to be a shock to no one, it is now down to Republican Steve Garvey versus Democrat Adam Schiff. Who are you endorsing?
Look, as big of a Dodger fan as I am, I'm endorsing and will be voting for Adam Schiff this November to be my colleague in the United States Senate come January of next year. It was a competitive race in the primary, but the voters spoke loudly and clearly with Schiff and Garvey in the solid, being the solid top two vote getters here. The contrast couldn't be clearer. In Adam Schiff, you have someone who has many years of public service under his belt, not just the champion that a lot of people got to know as a defender of democracy against attacks on democracy by former President Trump, but someone who for years before that has been a champion for labor rights, for environmental protection, for economic opportunity, and so much more. So I'm excited for November and to welcome him next Congress.
And I also heard that you actually welcomed him into the Democratic caucus this week and are already starting the process of sort of training him for the job. Can you talk to us about that?
Look, there's no time to lose. You know, we take the process seriously. There is still November, and I know a Congressman Schiff will campaign respectfully to earn the votes of Californians in November. But I'd be shocked and stunned if something went sideways and he was not victorious. So in the interest of being as prepared as possible to hit the ground as quickly as possible in the Senate, I thought it'd be worthwhile for him to join a meeting of Senate Democrats this last week, begins to know his future colleagues, many of which he already knows, having served together in the House of Representatives. But I think also just good politics. The more he's becoming part of this family quicker, the more we can engage him on the political side as well. You know, it's a Democrat versus a Republican this November in California, so we can afford to ask Congressman Schiff to help maybe raise funds or campaign for some of our incumbents in states that are going to be much more battleground states, not just for the presidential, but to determine the majority of the Senate next session. We know how important that is, and I know he's eager to jump into being part of the new team.
So how did that go? How did people react to him? What was he like in that meeting?
Oh, it was very welcoming. Again, there's a good number of my Senate colleagues that have served in the past in the House of Representatives and have known Adam and have worked with him on a number of issues. And even those he didn't recall how impressive he was during the first of the two Trump impeachment trials. And so people are eager to get to know him better. And again, really get down to work together. There's issues. As the now senior senator from California, still pinching myself when I think about that, look forward to partnering with him on a whole lot, including bringing much needed resources home to California.
So before you were California senator, you were the Secretary of State and you ran elections in California. Democratic Congresswoman Katie Porter, who of course ran against Adam Schiff, suggested that this election was rigged by billionaires and dark money interests. How do you respond to that claim?
Yeah, look, those comments, when I heard them, were certainly disappointing because of the seriousness with which we take election administration in California and beyond. And look, frankly, most people, when they hear the term rigged related to elections right now, immediately think of Donald Trump and his denying the outcome of the 2020 election. So at a minimum, poor choice of words. People deserve to know that, yes, we have integrity in the election process and the results in California. But what Sun has done, the primary is over. The results, while not final and certified, are pretty clear given the margins. And we're looking forward to a transition and the work ahead.
So you are the vice chair of the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee. Now, in that role, you're trying to elect Democratic senators. Katie Porter had made the argument that California would be better off having a Democrat versus Democrat in the fall, which would help drive turnout for House races down ballot. Do you agree with that?
Look, ultimately, you have to respect the process and the voters themselves. The voters have spoken. There was a robust campaign. Look, three good Democrats that were competitive in the primary, along with some Republican candidates and candidates of other parties, but the voters spoke loudly and clearly in determining who the top two were. So, like I said, we are moving forward. You know, with my Democratic Senate Campaign Committee hat on, I guess if there's one selfish takeaway, a competitive race in November would also translate into being an expensive race in November just for California. And we're going to have a Democrat at the end of the day. So now there's a lot of political resources available to invest in Montana, in Ohio, and Wisconsin, and Nevada, Arizona, other key states in determining who's going to be in the majority in the next Congress. I certainly will do everything I can to help reelect Joe Biden, but also make sure that we maintain a Democratic majority in the Senate while we look for the House to flip back to Democrats so we can get back to the business of advancing good policy that invests in working families, middle-class Americans, our nation's infrastructure, expanding access to health care, improving education opportunities, economic opportunities, and so much more, just like we did the first 2 years of the Biden administration.
Is there one or two races that you are most focused on in terms of nationwide, in terms of Senate campaigns, that maybe you would want the people of California to send money to?
Yeah, look, I don't know if I'd single just one or two out because, on the one hand, all politics is local, and on the other hand, anything can happen. There's still well more than 200 days between now and November. But I think some of the states that everybody agrees that we're keeping a close eye on are the state of Ohio, where my colleague, Sherrod Brown, is up for re-election. People think Ohio is getting tougher as a state, but Sherrod Brown certainly knows his state. He's very popular in his state. Looking forward to helping him get successfully reelected. The state of Montana, John Tester, the only Democrat elected statewide in Montana. To know John is to love John. The people of Montana love John, but he needs our help to get his message out and get reelected. Wisconsin, we never take for granted. Nevada was close last election, and the one before. Arizona was close last election, and the one before. So there's a lot of races that we don't expect landslides in. We just have to make sure the Democrats get elected so we can return to the good policy making and leadership that this country deserves.
I want to ask you about one of the big stories of the week. The House passed a bill that requires that TikTok be sold to a non-Chinese company or risk being banned in the U.S. It now heads to the Senate. Would you vote for that?
We're certainly taking the issue very seriously because based on initial briefings, there are very real national security concerns with the platform and more specifically the dangers of our data and private information being in the possession and subject to abuse by the Chinese Communist Party. So with the bill coming over from the House, particularly with such an overwhelming bipartisan vote, the Senate will take it seriously. We'll get updated briefings here in the near future. I imagine the Senate will vote on it, whether it's in this exact form or not. I don't know. We'll probably have to amend the bill to be very strategic, very intentional to make sure we avoid any unintended consequences with the version that was approved by the House. And just on that note, I got to make it clear, especially representing California, we are all for creativity. We are all for creative artists. And TikTok has become one of the most successful platforms for showcasing your creativity. So we're not trying to stifle that. But I think folks who do use the platform deserve to have confidence that their data, their personal information will not be subject to abuse. So we're trying to protect not just young people, but anybody that uses TikTok.
I mean, that sounded a little bit trying to have it both ways. I mean, the concept of the bill itself, agree with this concept that TikTok should be sold, and if it's not sold, that it should be banned?
I do agree with the premise of the bill. But again, the way the language is written, there's a lot of, I think, misimpressions out there that Congress is trying to shut down TikTok. You know, if the owners of TikTok are willing to do what they should do and disassociate themselves with the Chinese government, it's probably going to be better for their business. But I know it'll be better for users of the platform, many of whom are in the United States. So that's our obligation. Protect Americans. Let's incentivize creativity, and there's a way to do so if the leadership of TikTok agrees to it.
You were here on our set a few weeks ago talking about Proposition 1, which would be a bond to increase mental health spending in California. It was widely thought of as something that would pass with a big margin. It is really, really close. What do you think is the message that voters are sending with Proposition 1 and the fact that it is closer than a lot of people anticipated, certainly about a month ago?
Yeah, well, look, knowing full well the ballot counting process in California and how long it can take, we don't have the final results, but I'm confident that at the end of the day, the majority of voters will have approved Proposition 1. And it will not just mean new resources for tackling mental health and homelessness in California, but reprioritization so we can help address the needs of the most acute folks experiencing homelessness or mental illness in California. But the fact that the margin is not as big as maybe was initially hoped, I think is a reminder that Californians are telling policymakers at all levels, we want to make sure we're judicious with our resources and just be mindful of that, whether it's in future propositions, legislative proposals, or otherwise.
Let's end with something fun. We've talked a lot about baseball over the years and your Dodger fandom. But now you have a new favorite team, the Angels. Your son Alejandro is playing for the Angels in Little League. How's he doing, and what kind of fan are you?
Well, I did acquire an Angels hat to be able to root for him in the stands during his games. As you know, I'm a diehard Los Angeles Dodger fan. So my Major League loyalty is absolutely intact, but our kids come first. And if he's on the Angels, if as he's been on other teams, whoever he plays for, that's who I'm rooting for.
Are you like the loud, obnoxious dad, or what are you like at the ball game?
Look, in full honesty, and this isn't bragging, this is being real, I love the opportunities on the weekend when I get to help out with practices, even pitching batting practice with the kids. It's as grounding as you can imagine.
Well, good luck to him, and good luck to you out on the field.
Our thanks to Senator Padilla and to Leader Jeffries. A big week of Democratic politicians here on The Issue Is. We'll probably have a more conservative voice with us next week. This is just the way it worked out this week. Thank you so much for listening. Really appreciate it. Like, review, let people know about us. We really appreciate any feedback. Would love if you could reach out in social media as well, at Alex Michelson with an E in social media. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week for more of The Issue Is.